Hey folks, Tim Plett here. Welcome to today's Talky Bit. It's good to be with you. In very general terms, one of the recurring themes of this series of explorations that I've been calling Seeing Religions in 3D is this idea, kind of keeps bubbling up, that exclusivist belief systems don't work. And of course, if you're inside them, they work just fine. So, what do I mean by that? What I mean by don't work is, among other things, that those kinds of systems don't tend to treat other human beings as equals. And by other human beings, I mean those outside of the whatever the right beliefs are of that exclusivist system. Those kinds of systems, I believe, carry with them the danger of readily justifying things like diminishment and erasure and forced assimilation and conversion by coercion and other kinds of insistent and even violent forms of demanding that the other conform to the beliefs of the person or the group that's holding the power. And maybe one reason to recite something like a land acknowledgement, one reason to spend time in that space regularly, is to remind ourselves of the fact that there are many ways of approaching the sacred and that we will do a better job as humans of caring for one another as persons, whole persons, if we keep that in mind. So, when we gather in this part of the world, whether we do so virtually or in person, we do so on the lands of the Anishinaabe and the Cree, the Oji-Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Red River Métis Nation. We respect the treaties that were made on these territories. We acknowledge the harms and mistakes of the past, and we dedicate ourselves to moving forward in partnership with Indigenous persons and communities in a spirit of reconciliation and collaboration. Both of those last two descriptors, reconciliation and collaboration, of course, are marked contrasts to the spirit of colonization. So when we speak of these things, the sorts of things that are acknowledged in that land acknowledgement, or when we engage with them in action, we do that knowing that there cannot be reconciliation without the speaking of truth, including the truth about how our own systems of belief can contribute to both the breakdown and the rebuilding of relationship. And I believe with all my heart that we need to do whatever we can to infuse our worldviews with widening knowledge, deepening understanding, and opening arms, both for those we find it easy to identify with or be with, and those we don't. And so, in that spirit, let's go exploring. All right. If you've been following along, we have spent the last couple of talky bits digging into some general observations about religions. I'm just going to list these by way of review. We've observed that religions are cultural linguistic traditions, that they are human constructions, that they are responses to experiences of the sacred, that they are wisdom traditions or collections, that they exist primarily as means of deep transformation, and that they contain the possibility, and I believe the mandate actually, although we often lose sight of this, to be sacraments of the sacred, to be the things that we make that deliver the sacred to us, or move the sacred closer to us and us closer to the sacred, or more deeply into the sacred, depending where you imagine that starting. Now, if any of that sounds interesting to you, but you missed some past exploration, there are podcast episodes that touch on all of those topics. They're available on our website, thetablewinnipeg.com. And if you're a podcast listener in particular or not a regular, I want you to be aware that to listen to that stuff, you don't need to subscribe. You don't need to leave any information about yourself. We don't use cookies to track anything. You can just go to our website and you can listen right from there if you wish. You can also find those podcasts on iTunes and other podcatchers. And you can come and be a part of that when and how you choose to. And I think there's something lovely about that, not least of all because it means you can step in and step out as you feel able or available to that, or kind of like you have the capacity for that, which is really important. Being together in person, I think, is irreplaceable. I'm very excited that more and more of that is happening. And I would also say that it doesn't come with a sense of being risk-free, you know? Sometimes when we're exploring things that are difficult for us or that harken back to things that are difficult for us, I was just reviewing some comments from last week online, and people there discussing what it feels like to try to reclaim things that have caused hurt or harm, or invent new versions of things that, that did something well but no longer do, and so on and so forth, you know? Thinking about that this morning a little bit and kind of going, you know what, the podcasts are a good avenue for sort of incrementally exploring things that might feel like they're a little bit dangerous, a little bit difficult. Anyway, I wanted to mention all of that in part because of the things I just said, but also because although I try to have each of the Talkie Bits work as a standalone, this is a series where some connecting of the dots week by week can be really helpful in grasping the whole. All right, that feels a little bit like in-house advertising, so let's move on from that. I want to dig a bit into that same but different idea that I mentioned in the blurb. If you're pressed for time, let me give you the extremely brief version of this entire Talkie Bit. In fact, this one and next week. Religions are the same, but different. There you go. Back to whatever urgent matter was calling. You can come back another time for the details. Or you can stick around, because in this instance, I think the delight is in the details. That the nuanced version of that statement is far more interesting than the summary version is. We've been exploring sort of the same part of that same but different phrase for a couple of weeks now. That's one lens for understanding those six general observations that I just reviewed, that cultural, linguistic, human construction, so on, that list. What I want to start into today is to put a little bit more flesh on those bones, give a little more shape to the in common part of these stories. I don't know if you've noticed, but mysticism, or the values associated with mysticism, is showing up in some curious cultural locations these days. In very general terms, mysticism is the belief that union with or absorption in the deity or the absolute, what we've also talked about in this space as reality, is possible, even if only in momentary ways, and that there is knowledge that can be inaccessible to the intellect that can be attained through contemplation and self-surrender. I mean, you can look it up. That's a standard definition of mysticism. I won't repeat it, but that's sort of the gist of what we mean with that word generally. To put it into the kind of language we've been using in this space, mysticism could be thought of as experiences of the sacred. All right? And just a reminder, we've been using that word sacred in a pretty generous way, set within the notion that everything is sacred and that it's the presence of mystery, or what William James, you know, 105 years ago called more, that makes something sacred. In religions in general, the mystical strand tends to be the most experiential one. The mystical strand of most religions is the one that most people tell stories about. If you ask someone if they've had a religious experience, they're more likely to tell a story about something mystic than about something ritualistic, for example. Had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with someone whose education tilts toward head first, both literally and figuratively. This is a person with a degree in neuroscience. They're also someone that is decidedly Christian, making their living at the moment in the performing arts. And so I asked them how those pieces fit together. A neuroscience degree not typically being the educational path to a career in the performing arts. And they told me about an experience that they had as a dancer, where as they were dancing with some others, they started to feel as though they were not an individual so much as a part of the whole, that everyone and everything was connected. They were all communicating, everything was spinning and interwoven together. And that experience, which they called a God thing, is one that they as a person are equipped to consider from the vantage point of how the brain works, so how neuroscience might account for such an experience. But that neuroscientific explanation didn't quite do the whole job for them, because this experience felt like it went, I mean, how shall we say this? Like it went beyond that, or to a realm that includes but isn't bound by that explanation or what we can see through that lens. And they struggled to articulate that in our conversation, kind of like I'm struggling to articulate it and retelling it now. That realm of experience is one I'm generally referring to when I talk about mysticism. And what I mean by showing up in some curious cultural locations is that this idea that everything is connected and the language of everything is connected, that's starting to be part of the general and even popular scientific discourse. You can be doing serious science in the Western world these days and speak of how plants talk to one another or how material objects, including us, are constantly exchanging particles and not get booted off the island. And that wouldn't have been the case perhaps as recently as 20 years ago. And we'll come back to this, but because religions reflect the cultural contexts in which they're constructed, and we've been talking about that quite a bit, this shift in the cultural context and this shift in dialogue is one of the reasons why Western religions, including Christianity, are in such a state of flux these days, because they are made of the stuff of culture. And the culture is shifting enormously around matters that could be understood as accessing the terrain traditionally held by the mystics. In any case, one thing that almost all religions have in common is that they are grounded in experiences of the sacred, experiences of more. And the mystical strands of most religions are remarkably similar to one another. They tend to tell stories that sound a lot alike, and they might use different metaphors or different language, different sort of cultural imagery, but the experiences they're describing tend to be remarkably similar, which is quite amazing given that those stories come from wildly different cultural contexts and across a huge range of time frames. It's enough to make one think that maybe the mystics are on to something. Maybe everything is connected, and maybe if we're willing to let go of our insistence that we know how things work, or that we can primarily or even exhaustively approach knowing something with our head, and that kind of knowledge, head knowledge, if we're willing to let go of our insistence about that, maybe we too could become more conscious of that interconnectedness. We could become more of a participant, more of a conscious participant in that connectedness. All right, moving on. If the mystical strands of various religions are similar to one another, which is what I've been contending, then so too are the paths that they teach. Most religions have a path or a way that is at the center of their message. Sometimes it's overtly present in the language of that system, as it is in Buddhism, which speaks of the Eightfold Path. It uses the language of path. Sometimes it shows up in principles or it shows up in sacred teachings. We often hear that language used in and around indigenous wisdom traditions. So, for example, among the Anishinaabe people, whose homeland is right here in this part of the planet, the teachings of the Seven Grandfathers, also known simply as the Seven Teachings or the Seven Grandfathers, is a set of teachings that demonstrate what it means to live a good life. These are the teachings that that Wally outlined the last time he shared with us, and you can check those out on the podcast archive as well or in the Facebook archive. Those teachings detail human conduct toward others, the earth, and all of nature. In other words, they describe a path. They describe a way forward. They describe a means of transformation. And I often hear this in folks from within the indigenous community talking about, usually addressing some, responding to some dilemma in the media, being invited to speak to this, and saying over and over again, in a variety of ways, we need to get back to our traditional teachings. We need to return to the path, because the path describes a way of transformation, and there's something here that needs to be transformed, that needs to be deeply altered. If we grew up in or around Christianity, as many of us in this community did, and especially the young Western expressions with their emphasis on right belief, we might not even know that the earliest name of the Christian tradition that we know of was the Way. That's how it was referred to in its cultural context. This was the Way. And depending on how you look at it, Christianity could be seen as alarmingly not unique in this regard or reassuringly similar. We're going to parse that a little more as we go along, and I think we'll see, as is often the case, it's more of a both and rather than an either or in that regard. In any case, I find it fascinating how the paths that various religions teach are remarkably similar. Very broad brush comparison here just for a moment, starting with the tradition that I know the best, starting with Christianity. The Christian path is centrally symbolized by the cross, by that symbol. And depending on where you kind of grew up religious, that symbol might carry one of several different understandings. If you grew up around evangelical or more sort of fundamentalist sorts of versions of contemporary Christianity, then the cross might have been portrayed as primarily about Jesus getting killed by God because the humans in the story really deserve to die, but God is gracious, so he goes this route instead. Kind of an extension of the ancient Hebrew cultural ideas about sacrifice as necessary to appease the deity. And if you ever want to explore, and I did a little bit of this week, and oh my goodness. Anyway, if you ever want to explore any of the history of where this version of Christianity gets its underlying principles from, you kind of want a short, you know, you don't want to invest your life in studying this, which you could do, but if you want some shorthand on it, just look up Jonathan Edwards' 1741 sermon entitled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God on Wikipedia. Scroll down a little bit, and there's a section there called the 10 Considerations that were sort of the 10 points that he made in this sermon. 10 points. One sermon, not a series. Anyway, if you ever want to check that out, from my perspective, though, this suggestion that you might wish to do that comes with what I would say is like a 5-alarm trigger warning. Like, don't go there if you're feeling like you're still dealing with active sort of trauma from your religious experience in fundamentalist setting. The God of Jonathan Edwards, the picture of the deity that launched the so-called Great Awakening in the UK and eventually gave us the movement called Evangelicalism, is in full view in that wiki summary, and it's not a pretty picture. God is pissed in that picture, and hell is very physical reality. It is imminent. We are always a whisker away from it. Anyway, it's quite horrific. It's interesting to me, though, that this version of that central Christian symbol isn't the one that really covers the history of Christian meaning-making the best. If we grew up being told it was the only one, that can be hard to comprehend or apprehend. But from an historic point of view, that particular symbol that I just described, that Jonathan Edwards, God's mad, humans are sinful, deserve to die, Jesus gets in the way, saves the whole thing. That version of that symbol is less than 300 years old in terms of it's providing the framework for an entire sort of system of Christian belief. That's a blip on the screen. And the system that it launched is already waning, past its zenith, arguably. The more overarching, enduring version of that symbol is that the cross would be understood as a metaphor for the internal process of transformation, which, as we've just been discussing, is one that pretty much all religions are on about. It's a symbol for the psychological, spiritual process of dying to an old way of being and being born in a new way of being, of dying to an old identity and being born to a new identity. And I realize that die with one thing, be born to a new one, that can, again, trigger all sorts of things for us, depending how we've encountered that language or had it used toward us or around us. Having said that, listen to somebody talk about their discovery of how eating healthy cured their cancer. Listen to somebody talk about how discovering that line dancing, got an aching body and mind moving, or a socially frozen person out into the world. We could go on and on and on with stories of transformation. They're like, I used to be like that, but now I'm like this. That's what I'm talking about. Dying to one thing, being born to a new thing. All right, so it's that sort of broadly human an experience. It's not specific to particular religious applications of that that thing. If anyone has ever been through or been close to someone that's been through a change in identity, that I was and now I am, you know that this can be extremely powerful stuff. And we can think of all sorts of ways to reflect on that. Whether that's an experience from single to married or married to divorced or single again, whether that's from, whether if we take a family structure, whether that's a parent or not a parent, from no kids to kids, whether that's a change in gender identity, something we've been talking about a little bit again this morning, perhaps a change in national identity, professional identity. These are big transformative maneuvers. They are death to life kinds of changes. And again, speaking as a parent with, with two non sort of gender binary adult kids, watching the process of people work through their gender identity and sort of find their way through the swamp of all those messages that our culture sends about that stuff, and find their way to a space where they go, this is me, here I am, this is who I am in the world. Big work, big, scary, hard work. But also, my goodness, when we get to that place where we're like, this is the identity of life, this is what puts fuel in my engine every day. Very, very powerful stuff. Like death to life. When we think about it that way, perhaps it's easier to see why this is a recurring human theme that shows up in lots of religions. This is not unique to Christianity at all. So what the cross symbolizes in Christianity, I'm arguing here, is not unique. There's unique things made of it in Christianity. We'll talk about that later in this series. But what's going on at the core, shared very broadly. At the center of, let me just illustrate that a little bit. At the center of the Buddhist way or path, for example, is the idea of letting go. Now, once you're aware of this theme in Buddhism, you can start to have a deeper appreciation for how far this notion has penetrated Western thought and culture at this moment in history. It's kind of everywhere. And that's here in the West. And this is not a religion that came from the West. This is an import. The central meaning of that idea of letting go in Buddhism is that we are letting go of our prior understanding of who we are and what life is about, and we are being born into a new understanding of all of that, who we are as humans, what our place is in the world, what the nature of the world is, all of that stuff, new understanding. And not just a new cognitive or intellectual understanding, but a new way of being in the world. Again, as we explored last week, religions exist to mediate this new understanding of the sacred to the participant. That's what religion as a sacrament was about. It's like religion is a handle on the mystery. And the only way to have the experience of being carried toward the mystery by a religion is to participate, is to be in it, right? Otherwise, it's an idea, and that's not unimportant, but that's different than what transforms. So this idea of transformation is also central to the Muslim tradition. The word Islam itself means submission, which in that tradition means a radical centering in God and not in culture or tradition or self. One of the sayings attributed to Muhammad is, die before you die. Remarkably similar to the death and resurrection as a metaphor for a process that happens in this life, what the biblical writer Paul is talking about when he speaks of his old self being crucified and reborn in this, at the time, new understanding of the human relationship to the divine that was coming to be known as Christianity. So when he talks about, die to myself and being born again, born in Christ, that whole idea, that's what he's talking about. He's describing that kind of a transformation into this religious path, this religious way. Now, very briefly, just to kind of wrap this up for today, religions also tend to be very similar in their characteristic practices. Almost all religions have some form of worship rituals and embrace some form or forms of prayer. And I'm not going to unpack that much today, except to say that if you ever have or have had a chance to be present to another religious or cultural expression of worship other than the one you grew up with, if you grew up with one, and you go in looking at the experience through this kind of lens that we've been talking about, don't be surprised at all if you find yourself feeling something like, oh, I kind of get this. Or even feeling some sense of the presence of that mystery that you might have been told can only have one name or be accessed one way. One of the reasons for that might be understood by observing that the desired outcome of most religions is something along the lines of learning to live a life of compassion. It may be terribly obvious, but I feel compelled to add that, of course, religions are not the only way to learn to live a life of compassion. But that's what most of them are on about. Wally and Teresa, whom many of you will know in our community, were able to come by for our and lunch after last week. And a little aside here, again, if you're a podcast listener in particular, or you haven't had occasion, and lunch after is a Zoom hangout that we do following our Sunday morning gatherings. It doesn't happen every week. When we gather in person, we don't do it because we can do it in person. But when we gather online, then we do this most weeks. And it's just it's free range conversation, full on. I host it, but I don't give any direction to it in terms of planning or anything like that. And we follow our collective noses, and we get into all kinds of interesting corners every time, it seems like. Anyway, Wally and Teresa came by for and lunch after last week. And whenever that happens, because they're both Indigenous, I just want to auger into that perspective. You know, we can't all be in those things every time. And every time I get to be with them in that context, I want to hear their perspective about whatever we're talking about. Because personally, and this could be very selfish, perhaps, but also an authentic desire, I just feel like I have so much misinformation and negative bias to unravel. I was working with an Indigenous group of caregivers recently, and I made the observation in part of our conversation that I can remember a lot of my life being so racist that I didn't even know I was racist. You know, I just thought that's the way the world actually was. There's that much unraveling to do. And so when there's a chance to do some of that, I just want to dig in. Well, in the course of that conversation, Wally reiterated an idea that I've heard him touch on almost every time I've heard him speak. And that is the idea that shame and guilt as the felt expressions of acknowledging the mistakes of the past is not helpful. This isn't about that. This process of reconciliation, of collaboration, it's not about that. Even when we have to face hard historic truths, it's about learning and changing. It's about transformation. And Wally and Teresa as well, both do such a tremendous job of articulating this as well as living this, of just the spirit of kind of gracious hope in this stuff and not condemnation and shame. That perspective touches something really deep in me. It often makes me tear up when I'm in the presence of it. I think for my part, a lot of that is because that perspective feels like an antidote to all those years of seeing myself primarily as a sinner in the hands of an angry God, a perspective that didn't move me personally toward being more compassionate, but rather toward being more rebellious. It transformed me, but not in the way that a good version of religion is meant to. And now I'm having to find ways to undo a lot of that and come at it differently. And Wally's gracious spirit and practice of his traditional teachings is part of what is helping that to happen. The example of, for instance, Wally's life of compassion is one of the ways that I'm being transformed from death to life. If I were to cite other influences like that, near the top of the list would be the explorations and conversations that are part of the life of this community in an ongoing way. Those are hugely transformational for me, and I'm so grateful for that. All right. That personal note, it's where I'm going to leave it for today. Next week, we're going to spend a bit of time exploring ways of the terrain of differences in religions. And in a lot of ways, we've spent a couple of weeks now talking about sameness or similarity. But next week, we're going to be more into how to look at and think about those differences. And maybe we could think of that as a little bit more like the 3 in 3D in the series title. Anyway, you will decide, of course, but that's where I expect to be headed. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for being a part of this. And thanks for the interactions that flow out of these explorations. My deep hope is that those conversations and these explorations are as positively transformational for you as they continue to be for me. So good.